Hello and welcome back to Food Toxicology. I'm Greg Muller, the instructor for the course. Now, when I say pasteurization to most students, they immediately think of milk or dairy products, and the food safety process to decrease foodborne pathogenesis from these types of products. The lecture we're going to talk about today, we're going to talk about food irradiation. Food irradiation is regarded by some as a method of cold pasteurization to decrease food pathogens and also to increase shelf stability of many perishable food products. Our learning objectives here today, what we're going to try to do is define what food irradiation is. We're going to try to explore the background of ionizing radiation from a scientific perspective, what exactly is happening in this particular process, and how it can be applied to food. We're going to try to describe the various food irradiation processes. There's three of them. We're going to try to list some of the benefits of food irradiation, as well as some of the concerns for food safety, food quality, and also the non-food-based concerns of food irradiation, things like environmental impacts of any nuclear process. We're going to try to briefly explore some of the range of consumer opinions about food irradiation, and there are many. And we'll as well try to explore the current food uses and potential future of food irradiation. What we find is that food irradiation is the exposure of food products to ionizing radiation. That's key that we talk about ionizing radiation because radiation comes in many shapes and sizes. We use this to destroy microorganisms or insects and parasites that might cause disease or spoilage of food products. When we decrease spoilage, we increase the amount of food available for human consumption. Therein lies the potential strong benefit of a food process like irradiation. We can compare ionizing radiation to non-ionizing radiation that we use in normal food processing, such as cooking, which is an infrared process, or microwave ovens, which is essentially absorption of microwave energy with the water molecules. Ionizing radiation is different. It is from X-rays, or the radioactive decay of radioactive elements produces alpha particles, beta particles, or gamma rays. Typically, it's gamma rays that we use in food irradiation. In terms of ionizing radiation, it can cause chemical reactions and alterations of chemicals in tissues. In high dose, as you all know, it can be toxic, radiation poisoning, or fatal to humans. We do not make the food product radioactive when we do food irradiation. In terms of the interaction of this ionizing radiation and any organism, the reactivity is with primarily the water that's in the organism. What we can find is that it will produce superoxide radicals, hydroxyl radicals, hydroperoxyl radicals, and hydrogen peroxide. We dealt with all of these oxidizing substances when we talked about oxidative stress from free radicals. And so we're using the same process, this oxidative stress process, but this is not a toxic endpoint of concern in humans. We're essentially trying to intoxicate the organisms to kill them off via some oxidative processes. And if you remember the endpoints of oxidative stress in our target organ toxicology slide set, these endpoints include lipid peroxidation, DNA strand breaks. And this is important because if you have a strand break in DNA, there is the inability of that DNA to replicate. There's enzyme inactivation, covalent binding to nucleic acids, and covalent binding to proteins of various oxidative byproducts. The direct ionization of organic molecules can actually leave carbonium ions that can alkylate DNA, again causing a potential mutagenesis and non-reproduction of the organism. This is useful if our target organisms are microbes. In terms of ionizing radiation and human population, the concern we have most is radon. It's a noble gas that emits alpha particles. If you live in that part of the country where radon escapes from local geology, and this can include, for instance, granitic deposits in the subsurface, Sometimes that radon can collect in your basements. It is the largest radiation exposure in the human populations and presents the greatest amount of radioactive risk to the human population. In terms of how we use radioactive decay for food irradiation, radioactive decay is defined as the decrease in the amount of any radioactive material with the passage of time. And this is due to the spontaneous emission from the atomic nuclei of alpha or beta particles, and these can be accompanied by a photon event referred to as gamma radiation. I've given the formula for the radioactive decay of cobalt-60, a radionuclide that is used in food processing. The image you see here is radioactive cobalt-60 that's been immersed in water, and this is typically done to keep it cool during the stasis process. The glowing you hear about, and people will refer to as the radioactive glow, Chernikov radiation is characteristics of radioactive decay, and the high amount of energy in the interaction of excited state water, giving this luminescence, the glow, if you will. In terms of cobalt-60 radioactive decay, to give you an example of how we use radioactive decay and some of the energy put off in food irradiation, we have cobalt-60, a radionuclide. Its half-life, the time it takes for 50% of the original radionuclide to decay, in this case is about 5.24 years. This is a moderate half-life. Some metastable and unstable radionuclides have half-lives in seconds or minutes or hours, while others, such as plutonium, have half-lives on the order of tens of thousands of years. In terms of the decay of cobalt-60, it decays by emitting a 0.31 megaelectron volt beta particle, producing nickel-60. Nickel-60, metastable state, still radioactive, emits a gamma photon of 1.17 megaelectron volts, or MeVs. It then proceeds to another state, finally to its ground state, nickel, by emitting another gamma ray at 1.33 MeVs in terms of gamma radiation. So these high energy photons, the gamma radiation here, is what's actually used in food irradiation. Beta particles are actually relatively weak in terms of its ability, their ability to migrate through materials. Now, in terms of radioactive decay products, I've said alpha particles, beta particles, and gamma rays. It's good to know and understand what these are in terms of our understanding of radioactive decay. An alpha particle is a positively charged particle that ejects spontaneously from the nuclei of a radionuclide. It has low penetrating power and a relatively short range. In terms of human interaction, it will generally fail to penetrate the dead layers covering the surface of our skin. Alpha isotopes are actually, alpha-emitting isotopes are actually hazardous in terms of radiation safety because they essentially will be decaying, shooting off of these little particles, and if they are absorbed into the body via our food or water in terms of natural contamination, perhaps a nuclear event, this is one that is not a good health outcome in terms of the incessant nature of radioactive decay and the tissue damage associated with exposure to the energy associated with radioactive decay. Beta particles are charged particles. They are also emitted from a nucleus during this decay process. Its mass is about 1/2000 of a proton. It's a negatively charged beta particle is identical to an electron, where a positively charged beta particle is called a positron. Large amounts of beta radiation may cause some skin burning. Typically, beta particles can be shielded by thin sheets of either metal or plastic. Many students, and especially graduate students, may have worked with some beta particle emitters in terms of radio labeling substrates in research laboratories, and typically you will work behind not only lead, but sometimes sheets of acrylic plastic to make sure that you're not impacted. Gamma rays are high-energy, short-wavelength electromagnetic radiation. They're photons, a packet of energy that are emitted from the nucleus in terms of the decay of these radionuclides. It frequently accompanies alpha and beta particle emissions, and they always accompany a fission process. These gamma rays are strong enough to be considered ionizing radiation. They're very penetrating. These energy units are stopped by very dense materials such as lead or uranium or thick walls of concrete. And so this is your typical sort of radioactive safety issue in terms of having thick walls, lead materials, lead containers to stop gamma radiation. They're similar to X-rays in the fact that they have no mass or charge. It's good for us to be able to look at the electromagnetic spectrum in terms of analysis of these energies. Here is kind of the visible spectrum of UV from about 400 nanometers to about 700 nanometers in terms of the wavelength visible to IR. It's actually a small segment here identified in white on this graphic of what we actually see in terms of the visible spectrum. In terms of food preparation, thermal infrared is the cooking energy that we are most typically using, whether it's by flame or by electrical resistance or steam in ovens. Microwave radiation, in terms of the advent of the microwave about 25, 30 years ago, in terms of common use in food production. But as we go in this direction, we go higher energy. And so the UVs and the VUVs are the photons that give us sunburn. They're more energetic. As you get out in here past the ultraviolet, you find X-rays, and finally gamma rays being highly energetic, and these are ionizing radiation up here. In terms of how we measure radiation, for example, in applications like food irradiation, we use the unit of gray. A gray is the absorption of 1 joule of radiation, that's an energy unit, by 1 kilogram of matter. And so 1 gray is equal to 1 joule per kilogram. You may hear often, especially in the US, the term RAD. These are radiation absorbed dose. RADs are the older unit. There is an equivalence that 100 RADs is equal to 1 gray if you want to interpret across the two units. I'm encouraging that you learn and adopt the gray and the kilogray, which is 1,000 grays, as the units, especially in reference to food irradiation. In terms of the lethal doses of radiation, we have all of those potential oxidative stress outcomes in terms of how radiation, ionizing radiation, can interact via the production of all of these oxidizing substances and reactive endpoints in the molecules of life. In terms of vegetative bacteria, about 0.5 to 10 kilogray is the range of lethal dose. Bacterial spores, significantly higher. And so if we want to sterilize a food product for bacterial spores, we have to get extremely high in terms of the ionizing energy, the radiation dose associated with food irradiation. For people and animals, we're not trying to kill them, but it's good to know what the radiation dose is that will bring on lethality, and this can be 5 one-thousandths of a gray to 10 one-thousandths of a kilogray. These are very small levels in terms of our ability. And typically radiation sickness, radiation poisoning, is an overdose of damage, if you will, to the human body such that we cannot compensate our systems, for instance, of repair, our fibrinogen to repair leaks and oxidative damage, turnover of key critical enzymes, is sufficiently diminished that radiation sickness can often be terminal. Insects, lethal doses, a tenth to 1 kilogray. Now, in terms of food irradiation, this is the radiation energy typically as gamma rays applied to food. This radiation does not induce radioactivity in the food, an important point to make. So when you hear in common parlance, for instance, in the application of microwave to nuke your food, microwave application is not a nuclear process at all. And food irradiation is a nuclear process only in that we are using the energy from nuclear decay to produce the changes in the food product. We are not introducing radioactivity. In food irradiation, we typically will use either gamma radiation, and that can be ionizing radiation from cobalt-60 radionuclide or cesium-137. Cobalt-60, again, has a 5.2-year half-life. Cesium has about a 12-year half-life. In terms of managing the source, both of these are useful. Cesium-137 and cobalt-60 are both medical use isotopes, if you've ever heard of radiation therapy, for either imaging or for cancer therapy. We also use X-rays, and you saw on the graphic in terms of the energy spectrum that these are high-energy photons. These typically are from X-ray tubes where we have a high-energy photon that results from accelerating a beam of electrons with typically tungsten metal in an X-ray cathode tube. We also are finding application in terms of food radiation from accelerated electrons where we have an electron beam accelerator, and we use these accelerated electrons to ionize food products as well. What happens with these various types of ionizing radiation? They pass through the food. They have sufficient energy. You saw that we need lead or 5-foot concrete to actually stop gamma radiation. It easily passes through a food product and does its ionizing job on the way through the food product. What we find is that ionizing radiation does pass through a food product without generating intense heat, the intense heat that might be associated with some sterilization processes like pasteurization. So that's where you get the term cold pasteurization that some people call food irradiation. This ionizing radiation will disrupt some cellular processes, and because it will scissor DNA, can scissor DNA at high enough radiation level doses, it can inhibit various processes such as sprouting and microorganism replication. In terms of the historical use and application of ionizing radiation in food technology, we had the discovery of X-rays in 1895 by William Rentgen, showing actually he discovered this by actually putting his hand up, holding a piece of metal in front of an X-ray beam and seeing the image of his hand appear on a screen. Essentially saying that the X-rays would go through soft tissue but not bone. In 1896, just a year later, it was suggested for use in food preservation. 1903, very early on, over a century ago, it was patented by the U.S. and France, primarily a destruction of parasites like Trichinella in pork. The cost and scarcity of radiation sources was a problem in terms of industry interest. There was, in terms of early application of X-rays and the power associated with early X-ray machines, adverse sensory attribute development. Military research continued in terms of sterilization for stable field rations. In 1962, the Army Research Facility in Massachusetts did a lot of the background research on food irradiation, primarily for military rations. They demonstrated meat shelf life in years without refrigeration, and they performed many of the early safety studies that is the basis for much of the toxicology data associated with especially human food consumption of irradiated food products. In 1958, the U.S. FDA ruled traditional irradiation as a food additive, and so we now have the interface of food irradiation and FFDCA. It is part of the Food Additives Amendment. This somewhat delayed commercialization because now everything associated with food irradiation had to go through a petition under FFDCA. The industry finally lost interest in the late 1960s. There was an FDA approval of irradiation of potatoes for sprout inhibition and for grains to reduce insect infestation. In 1965, we find that the Surgeon General announced that irradiated foods were safe and wholesome. NASA has been using food irradiation for rations for its astronauts, especially for high-energy, high-dose sterilization processes. In 1991, the U.S. opened the first commercial U.S. commercial irradiation plant, Vindicator of Florida, for commercial food irradiation. There are various processes in terms of the intensity of the dose, and these lead to categories of food irradiation: radiurization, radication, radicidation, radaporization, if I can pronounce those correctly. And these are all based on radiation dose. In various graphics here, you'll see the international symbol for irradiated food product. It's this small circular green plant. We'll talk about it later in the lecture. It's called the Radura. Now, in terms of the radiation processes, radiurization, this is a radiation dose of 0.75 to 2.5 kilograys. What we find is that it can inhibit sprouting, delay ripening, it'll de-infestate insects from food products and give many food products shelf life extension. This particular lower dose radiation process mimics pasteurization. This gives you an example in this graphic of strawberries treated at 1 kilogray and then stored for 25 days at 3°C. You can see the background control here, and here's the irradiated at 1 kilogray, and here's irradiated at 1.5 kilogray. This is heated for 10 minutes control down here, and this is heated and irradiated. And you can see shelf stability of the food product by the absence of mold indicated in the controls. Radicidation is 2.5 to 10 kilograys. It eliminates spoilage, microorganisms, and non-spore forming pathogens. The problem associated with this reduction in pathogens, it's not a complete reduction. And although it might eliminate some spoilage microorganisms because it doesn't eliminate spore-forming bacteria, for example, there still may be a problem associated with some foodborne pathogens. Radaporization is 10 to 50 kilogray. This is a high-dose radiation process. It reduces microorganisms to the point of sterility. This is useful in many applications. For instance, it mimics the 12D process for Clostridial botulinum, 12 spore reduction of 12.9% reduction, 12 log cycle reduction in spore forming. It's not approved for general use in food. It's a high energy, high dose process. It is perhaps got application in diets for the immune deficient and for military and NASA operations where sterility and very long shelf stability is required. Next three slides give you kind of a presentation of what the various types of facilities look like in each one of these cartoons. The idea in terms of is very straightforward. Typically, we have a source in terms of the ionizing radiation. In this particular place, we have the storage pool, and you can see it blue from the Chernikov radiation. The control materials, in this case, the cobalt 60 materials, are raised into the radiation room. The radiation is then dosed to a food commodity that is going into and out of the protected radiation shielded facility on a moving conveyor belt. They're loaded and unloaded pre and post processing. In terms of an X-ray facility, we've all gone to the doctor to get an X-ray. Think of yourself as a palletized food product going into and out of an X-ray facility where we have high energy, X-rays being beamed down onto food products being passed on a moving pallet system. In terms of electron beam facilities, a similar sort of process. We have an electron beam accelerator and then various electron optics to change the direction of the beam. The beam is then directed down here to the food product for the ionization and sterilization of the food product. Now, some of the benefits of food irradiation include reduction in foodborne disease in a very similar way to pasteurization of dairy products. There is a reduction in food spoilage and therefore the resulting increase in the food supply from in terms of food availability. There is a reduction of insect infestations. There is a prevention of sprouting. It delays ripening to enhance shelf stability. It does have the indirect effect of reducing the use of fumigants in terms of food storage, in terms of food warehousing. It is cheaper than freezing and refrigeration in terms of enhanced saving of perishable foods. The food safety concerns associated with food irradiation have been managed by FDA. They have gone into four basic aspects of food safety: the radiological safety, the toxicological safety in terms of the production of free radicals and the free radical products that are unique to food irradiation. Reviewing the microbiological safety associated with food safety and food irradiation, and as well the preservation or reduction in nutrients associated with food irradiation. Now, in terms of radiation or radiological safety, there is no concern because the gamma rays associated with food irradiation processes are too low of energy to produce any sort of radioactivity, an excited state radioactive products within food. In terms of the safety concerns regarding toxicity of some of the products, the Bureau of Foods Radiated Foods Committee reviewed all the available toxicology data, essentially declaring that no toxicology studies were required at 1 kilogray or below the doses of these low-dose radiation events. And this has to do with the relatively low consumption of foods in the diet that might be a part of an irradiation preservation or food protection scheme. The higher doses that might be used in food irradiation need to be managed on a case-by-case review basis in terms of the potential production of these unique radiolytic products. These concerns are for radiation above 1 kilogray. These are for various food products. The idea in terms of the approach might be is for FDA that chemi-generic clearance concept is forwarded. This means that the foods of the same class, for instance carbohydrate-containing foods, will produce similar products in terms of the oxidative pathway of carbohydrates. For example, a recent paper talked about the effects of irradiation on apple juice and the potential for increased levels of melanodialdehyde, MDA, which is a known mutagen. The toxicity studies as well from FDA's point of view that deal with one muscle food could serve as a source of data for others, so there's a crossover in terms of risk assessment for chicken, red meat, or fish. In terms of the food safety concerns of free radicals that are formed in this ionizing radiation process, remember that free radicals are also formed by exposure to sunlight and various food processing, food cooking techniques like frying and baking, grinding and drying. Free radicals are extremely reactive. Most disappear within milliseconds in terms of their reactivity. They're extraordinarily electrophilic, and there's many chances for it to react in the food product. This reactivity is actually part of the basis of the food irradiation process. There are fewer changes in food irradiation than typical cooking in terms of chemical changes of the food. Some of these are positive, but as you can imagine, some are negative in terms of sensory attributes of the food. From a toxicology point of view, the toxicity studies show no adverse effects from the free radicals caused in the food ionization. There are some concerns about the production of URPs, or unique radiolytic products, active byproducts of the free radicals that are formed, the oxidative byproducts that are unique to this particular process and not necessarily found in normal food processing or food cooking. As it turns out, the URPs occur at very low levels. We all know about dose response, and so there's a need to analyze the toxicity at these very low doses. The toxicity trials that we have done with these URPs in foods suggest that there is toxicity of concern. Alkyl cyclobutones is a URP that may be a marker that we can analyze in terms of the relative proportion of URPs that are produced in a food type from ionizing radiation. FDA makes two assumptions regarding URPs from food irradiation. They assume that URPs are formed. They assume that a 1 kilogray dose will actually yield 3 milligrams of URPs per kilogram of food. This is actually a much higher, this is a risk assessment, a model term. The maximum concentration of URPs is then estimated to be 3 parts per million, 3 milligrams per kilogram of food. This is the basis of the acceptance for irradiated food up to 1 kilogray without any required animal testing in terms of approvals. There are also some food safety concerns regarding microbiological attributes of food irradiation. Can we actually, because we are potentially mutating DNA, can we mutate the microbes and therefore produce more virulent pathogens? Will irradiation reduce some spoilage microbes and therefore reduce some competition for some of the pathogens that aren't as greatly impacted by food irradiation? In this image as well, you can see the Radura symbol in terms of food irradiation for this basket of fruit that has been irradiated. Now, there is no evidence that radiation-induced increases virulence. We do find, for instance, some radophiles, microbes that grow in high radiation environments like nuclear power plants. We don't find that in food products. There's more evidence that there is decreased virulence of any surviving microorganisms following food irradiation. FDA does require proof the process reduces target microbes without allowing botulinum growth in the food product. As it turns out, the major food spoilage bacteria are gram-negative psychrotrophs, and they are virtually eliminated by 1 kilogray radiation. Gram-positive spoilage bacteria are quite resistant, however, up to about 5 kilogray. That also represents a potential analysis technique of looking at the general proportions in background food products and in irradiated food products of gram-negative to gram-positive bacteria as an indicator that a food has been irradiated. There are some nutritional concerns about food irradiation, questions such as does this irradiation reduce the nutritional quality of food? Is it the food irradiated a significant source of an affected nutrient if there is a change? What FDA has found in their analyses is that there is no effect of radiation on trace elements or minerals, and this would be obvious because there's no way to kind of get rid of trace elements or minerals and have an effect. You might have a change in terms of the complexation, the binding or the presentation and absorption and uptake, but you don't get rid of the element itself. There is a potential to change proteins, carbohydrates, and fats, but FDA found in their analysis that they are not affected up to 10 kilogray of dose in food irradiation. There are some small macronutrient losses up to 50 kilogray high dose applications. In terms of nutritional sensitivity. As you would imagine, vitamins, and particularly antioxidant vitamins, are perhaps the most sensitive. Remember that we are inducing oxidative processes in the food product. If there are antioxidant chemicals, there is a higher potential for those to react and therefore not be available in the final finished food product. There is a varying, there's a dependence on dose, temperature, the atmosphere in terms of where this takes place and the food type. There are findings that low temperature and limited oxygen in the environment of the dosing is best. There appears to be some enhanced nutrition in the case of water-soluble vitamins from food irradiation, but the overall conclusion is that you're not likely to have a vitamin deficiency resulting from eating irradiated foods. In terms of the World Health Organization policy statements on the food safety of irradiated foods, they find that there is no adverse toxicological effects on human health. There are no increased microbiological risk. There are no adverse effects on nutritional status. And they also find that irradiated foods can be regarded as safe and wholesome at any radiation dose currently used in food irradiation. There are some concerns in terms of the sensory attributes of food. Some of the early trials actually produced some very undesirable sensory qualities, especially in meat. The sensory attributes include burnt, metallic, bitter, cheesy, goaty, or wet dog-like sense of smell and taste to the product, obviously an undesirable attribute, no matter what the benefits. There are problems with doses as low as 1.5 kilogray. Higher doses appear to produce more sensory effects. This has caused the marketplace in terms of meat applications to be very wary of food irradiation. What happens in terms of meat products? The oxidation of myoglobin and fat in meat will cause some off odor and off flavor components by people that have researched actual process associated with the production of these negative sensory attributes. They can be controlled by irradiating at low temperature in an oxygen-free atmosphere. Some products have been found to be not suitable for radiation. There is some softening evident in some fruits and changes in some aroma and texture, for example, in grapefruits, oranges, pears, avocado, cantaloupes, and plums. In dairy products, there is the development of some off odors upon irradiation. There are also concerns in terms of the application of food irradiation and packaging. You can, for example, release gases. There will be an impact not only with the food product, but with the packaging material and the chemicals used in manufacturing it. There is the potential for release of low molecular weight hydrocarbons, plasticizers, cross-linking agents, and some of the halogenated polymers associated with food packaging materials. FDA must approve all packaging material used in food irradiation under 21 CFR 179.45. In terms of the international regulation of food irradiation, the International Joint Experts Committee on Food Irradiation had a policy statement in 1970, stated that irradiation at 10 kilogray was safe. In 1970, FDA approved, again, the 1 kilogray dose in terms of not requiring additional toxicology studies. It had negligible, unique radiolytic products. It did protect against some food spoilage organisms, and typically food would spoil before toxins from the microorganisms not impacted by food irradiation would develop. In terms of the requirements for labeling, on the wholesale basis, products are marked with treated by irradiation, do not irradiate again, to make sure that food products are not double dosed. In terms of a retail, there needs to be a treated by radiation or treated by irradiation with the international Radura symbol down here at the bottom of this particular slide. It's perhaps in several different colors, from black to green to pink and orange. but the symbol of the plant in a hatched circle. There are other statements permitted about the purpose of the radiation and type in terms of consumer education, that the irradiation was done to preserve freshness, to control pathogens. There's some current FDA review associated with food labeling by food irradiation. Some of the terms that have been suggested in terms of enhancing the consumer acceptance of this technique are using the terminology cold pasteurization as opposed to anything with the radiation. Typically, what people find is that once consumers are better educated about the process, there is a higher degree of consumer acceptance. In 1983, there was an approval in terms of food irradiation regulation of a 30 kilogray dose level for spices. There's problems of infestation in a range of spices. They do compromise a very small percent of the diet. The various chemical fumigants that were being used in spice preservation were being banned, and there was really no other practical way of treatment. In terms of the recent regulatory history in specific foods, 1963, 0.5 kilogray was approved for wheat and flour for insect control, 1964, 0.15 kilogray for white potatoes and sprouting. Trichinella was treated pending approval in 1985 at 1 kilogray. Fresh fruit, 1 kilogray in 1986 to delay ripening and infestation, for example, that we saw in strawberries. In 1990, poultry was approved at 3 kilogray for microbial control. Packaged frozen meat only for NASA was approved at 44 kilogray, and this is again for sterilization of that particular food product in a very particular application. In 1997, 4.5 kilogray for frozen chilled meats for microbial control. What we find globally is that there are about 50 routinely irradiated foods in about 36 countries. Numerous countries have irradiation facilities. In terms of consumer acceptance, 1995 survey examined the impact of irradiated foods in the marketplace. 72% of the respondents were aware of the process, 82% did not know much about it, 45% indicated they would buy it, while 19% indicated they would not buy it, 36% had not made a choice or a decision or formed an opinion on food irradiation. Most were worried about food additives, pesticides, animal drugs, hormones, and bacteria in food products. This particular survey indicated that consumers are willing to pay about 81 cents per meal to avoid a foodborne illness. This is about 10 times the cost of irradiation in terms of food production. 92% in some surveys indicated they favored some sort of labeling, again, to make a consumer choice about whether or not to use foods that had been irradiated. In terms of food irradiation problems associated with the regulation in the marketplace, by looking at a food, you can't really tell if it has been irradiated, and so that's why labeling has become a major issue. But many of these same challenges occur by other methods of preservation. Another problem in terms of management is assessing the dose of radiation to make sure that in a HACCP sort of environment that you can control in terms of good manufacturing practices, what foods are being dosed and at what dose they are being treated. In terms of the detection of food irradiation, in terms of follow-up analysis, we can look at food irradiation byproducts from a chemical, physical, histological, and morphological analytical process. In terms of chemical analysis, we can look at lipids and DNA. We can look at some byproducts like 2-alkyl cyclobutone as one of the markers from irradiated fatty acids. In terms of analysis proof of concept, there is a 99% detection in 134 samples that either were or were not irradiated. DNA analysis shows some promise. There are single and double strand breaks and cross-linking changes in terms of DNA. It is harder to tell from other processing effects that might be associated with denaturing the DNA in terms of traditional cooking and processing. In terms of physical attributes that might be used in detection of food irradiation, things like membrane damage, electrical impedance changes, for example, in potatoes, doing electron spin resonance, a form of spectroscopy on bone-containing food or shellfish, and thermal and near-infrared analyses, for example, on spices, doing a comparison pattern recognition analysis of the near-IR patterns. We can also use histology to look at the viability of seeds and fruit, examine for cell structural damage associated with irradiation. This is a little bit time-consuming, may not be practical for a routine analysis. And as I said before, because we have a higher degree of interaction of radiation, ionizing radiation with gram-negative to bacteria, the ratio of gram-positive to gram-negative bacteria might be useful as, again, a benchmark of radiation. Now, in terms of some of the best candidates for detection, for lipid foods, these hydrocarbons or alkyl cyclobutones, for bone-containing, again, ESR, thermoluminescence for spices, but it's apparent at this point that no one technique is available for all foods that might have undergone food irradiation. In terms of non-food-related concerns about food irradiation processes, there's obviously workplace exposure to people that are employed at food irradiation facilities or obviously to the nearby public. The potential for increased risk of nuclear accidents, the potential to add to nuclear waste, and perhaps its approach to managing radioactive waste, the development of radiation-resistant microbes, and the effect on potential effect on the environment and groundwater. All of these concerns are similar concerns to other uses of radiation, including the radiation, for instance, the cesium-137 or cobalt-60 pencils that are used in medical applications of in radiologic medicine. In terms of radiation hazards to workers, these sorts of applications and storage of radioactive materials are extraordinarily highly regulated, especially now in the days of terrorism. There is tremendous access control and safety, almost military bunker-like in terms of preserving security around these facilities. The only incidents that may happen in these facilities would be a violation of safety procedures that are on the same order of violations of safety procedures at any hazardous material workplace, such as being electrocuted in a plant. Having worked in various processing plants in my life, in paper mills and pulp mills, these are hazardous places as well. Examining the potential for increased nuclear accidents in these type of processes, this is not a nuclear power plant. There's no effluent, no real strong potential for release. The cobalt pencils, and they look just like pencils, about 12 inches long, about half a centimeter wide. They can actually be stored on site. They have about a 5.3 half-year half-life. There is no real possibility of meltdown in these particular situations because the energies are too low. They actually tend to store their own waste on site, and it's not a huge amount of radioactive material that's required for food irradiation. The total cobalt-60 production in the United States, I believe, is would fill about 1 or 2 square meters a year. In terms of adding to nuclear waste, cobalt pencils are pretty negligible. There's about negligible compared to total nuclear waste, which values about 2.7 million cubic feet per year. There is a potential that, in fact, low-level waste can actually be used for this particular application. In terms of the generation of radiation-resistant microbes, we find that they do exist, and they're not particularly competitive in terms of people that have done microbial research, and they're not particularly viable. In terms of groundwater impacts, cobalt-60 is not water-soluble, and it isn't typically an environmental concern. Now, in terms of the future and food irradiation, we find that there is an implementation following its approval of using food irradiation in meat and poultry processing. We may see more of that in the future. And this might be not necessarily by the gamma radiation, but by X-rays and electron beams, these second generation techniques. There needs to be a development of suitable packaging such that the ionizing radiation will have minimal impact in terms of the transfer of contaminants from packaging into the food product. There'll have to be an additional effort to develop methods to detect irradiated foods so we can do marketplace surveys and so that consumers that have expressed a preference, a choice in the marketplace based on their own needs and desires can actually have access to the food that they want, whether it be irradiated or not. We obviously need additional education of the public on the risks and benefits associated with food irradiation, and as well additional research in terms of satisfying the demands of the precautionary principle, satisfying the demands of life cycle assessment of this new process for food technology. Well, that again gives you perhaps a limited introduction, but enough knowledge to understand the potential food toxicology interaction with food irradiation. Next time, what we're going to do for a series of two lectures is actually start talking about the natural world and some of the natural toxicants that nature presents to us in terms of our relationship to environment, our relationship to plant and animal systems. Until that time, we'll see you again. Thanks.